Welcome to Special Sauce, Serious Seeds podcast about food and life.
My partner really was amazing, and watching him yell at people, I was like, can you hold on? Let me get my phone, because this is going to go viral on YouTube. You're going to be like a sensation. This little tiny French guy yelling at all these people.
We're back with author and sweets blogging hero and pastry chef David Leibovitz, the author of two recently published books, The Apartment Renovation Memoir, I'm calling it, L'Appart.
L'Appart.
And the updated and revised 10th anniversary edition of The Perfect Scoop, which is pretty awesome.
Well, thank you. It was a busy couple of years.
Yeah, I bet it was.
After writing about the apartment, it was fun to sort of make ice cream. I was like,
right.
Because it's hard to be unhappy when you're making ice cream. So, and I love making ice creams.
You know, we had an editor, Max Falkowitz, who's an ice cream freak.
Yeah.
Your book is one of his Bibles, and he takes ice cream, as you know, extremely seriously.
Yes.
So you're in Paris. You don't know anybody except for David Tanis. He's probably busy doing his own thing. Mm-hmm. You're blogging up a storm. When did it become a big part of you earning a living? And is that how you made a living when you first got to Paris?
No. You know, I used to speak at some blogging conference.
Right.
Like, how can I make money? How can I do this? I'm like, well, first do it for free for 8 years. And then, you know, and the whole idea of monetization didn't even occur. You know, I remember the first time there was like Google ads or something and you might make like $9 and you were so excited. And, you know, for some people, it started becoming a business over the years to people. But that was never the focus of my blog. And, you know, you're seeing that now more and more with social media. People are influencers and they're getting stuff. They're being paid to write
right.
or put pictures of things on their sites and on their social media. And that's what they do. It's not who I am.
And it's also, to me, a lot of those people, not all of them, they're as much marketers as they are creative people. And they're really good marketers.
Well, sometimes I feel like I'm the biggest idiot in the world. I have a lot of followers. I have high engagement. But a couple times I've been offered trips to go somewhere and like to get paid to write. It's like, well, you know, I tell people you write because you want to give. You want to give people something. You want to give them a story. You want to give them a recipe. You're not doing what you do to get stuff. You know, you do this podcast because you like to talk and you like to meet people and you like to entertain listeners. You know, whether you're getting $1 or $1 million, it's not, you know.
No, it's true. That's the way I've always lived my life.
Yeah, and a lot of people I know, that's how we live our lives. So, you know, on the other hand, I'm probably an idiot and I should just cash out now. And as soon as this is over, answer all those emails.
My book is going to be the story of my idiocy.
Yeah, but you have to make a decision in life. You know, once again, we were talking in the other episode about Chez Panisse. You have to make a decision, like, do we want to support the organic butter people for $7 a pound or buy regular butter for $3? And, you know, we all make decisions all the time. You know, sometimes, you know, I'm not always the cleanest. You know, I'm sometimes going to buy the $3 a pound butter. It's whatever. But it's sort of a general comportment.
So you were blogging, not making any money from it.
Right. And it was a lot of work, but it was fun because I was actually, you know, I was going through a lot of changes in my life and I was working them out. I was, you know, if you look at my old blog posts, they were really goofy. A lot of people delete their old blog posts. They're like,
right.
Oh, no. It's... And some of my stuff is like really like silly, stupid, bad.
Welcome to the silly, stupid, bad blog club.
But it's, you know, it's your history and it's like the stuff you did when you were 16. You know, it's like, oh, God, you know, what did I do? Well, how stupid was I? It's like, well, you weren't where you are now.
Right.
And so it's okay. That's where I was then.
Sure.
And
so how were you making money?
Well, I didn't need that much. I was living very frugally. You know, I was living in a one-room apartment. And, you know, it was tiny. I didn't have a lot of expenses. Like, obviously, I don't wear fancy clothes.
You know? I don't know. I think that shirt's like a $350 no. Hermes shirt, is it not?
Okay, I got this. It's on eBay. Seriously, it's a J. Crew shirt. I think it might have been $14.
It's a used J. Crew shirt.
Yeah.
All right,
but that stuff looks better used.
Yeah,
so,
yeah.
Yeah, let someone else break it.
Right.
Yeah. You know, but
so you didn't have many expenses.
You know, I was writing cookbooks. And I was doing okay.
You were working at a fishmonger for a little bit.
Well, I did that because I wanted to learn how to cut up fish.
Right.
And because the guys who worked at this fish shop were unusually handsome. And I used to go to the fish shop. Even like my straight male friends were like, yes, those guys are really, really handsome.
People used to say that about the guys that throw the salmon around in Seattle.
Well, you know, you probably get, you know, they're lifting food.
Right,
lifting
so you get
things.
Buff.
Yeah. So, you know, they said they would let me work there for a month with them, and it was really difficult. You know, starting at 5 a.m, it was super cold. You know, fish is cold. It's slimy, you know. And it's clean, but it was a very clean place. But I didn't know what I was doing. And, you know, they're, like, teaching me how to, like, open up a fish. And, you know, it's kind of like surgery. You know, there's a line you got to cut. There's a thing you pull it back. Then all this stuff spills out. And then, you know.
Right.
All of a sudden you're seeing, you know, what the fish ate, you know, the last week. And it's like, you know. Or the fish is alive and you're kind of, you know.
Right. It's flopping.
Yeah. So. It was good. It was a good experience for me.
But then they fired you unceremoniously.
Oh, I don't remember being fired.
You said in the book you didn't call it fired. You were asked to leave because of some French work requirement or something.
Oh, well, you're not. Yeah, you're not supposed to work without papers and
right.
You know, like there's a whole. If you want to do an internship in France, there's a way to. They fill out paperwork and they hire you. And I was just kind of doing it for the experience, you know. It was great, and I, you know, go to that fish shop all the time. Most of the guys have left. One guy was actually working across the street from me, and he used to talk to me. And my partner's like, "How do you know that like amazingly handsome guy?" You know, I'm like, "Well, he's, you know, Sebastian. He worked at the fish shop, so he's my pal."
And that's, you know, awesome.
Make yourself scarce when he's talking to me.
So you didn't write your first book about Paris until 2011, which was The Sweet Life in Paris. And it's kind of a guidebook, but it's not a guidebook to eating in Paris. It's kind of a guidebook to living in Paris. And it's a very personal guidebook. It has some recipes. But I was rereading it, preparing for this. And I realized I learned something so important when I read that book for the first time, which you say the most important phrase you need to know to get along in Paris is bonjour, monsieur.
Right. Yes, you have to say hello.
You have to say hello. When you walk into a store, you don't say, "I'd like two baguettes and two croissants."
Yeah.
You say, hello.
Right. Or when you go to, like, the doctor's office, you say hello to everyone in the waiting room. You don't have a conversation with them, but you say hello. You greet everybody.
Individually?
No, you just say bonjour, bonjour.
Bonjour.
Or you get in an elevator, you acknowledge everybody.
Wow.
And it's I always tell people it's like going to someone's house for dinner. Like, you don't just walk in, you say hello. So, you know, it was actually funny. I was with my partner who's Parisian, and we were in the south of France, and we went to a fish restaurant, and he went up to the guy who was, you know, selling the fish and, you know, for dinner. And he goes, "Well, what kind of fish do you recommend today?" And the guy looked at me and goes, "Bonjour, monsieur."
But it's true. I remember reading the book and then going to Paris, and then I was like, David Leibovitz is right.
Yeah.
This is before I'd met you.
Yeah. Like, and we just don't do that in our, you know, now when I'm in New York this week, you know, when I leave like Walgreens, I'm like, "Merci, you know, thank you," like waving at the cashiers, and they're like, "Who's the crazy guy?" You know, and they're just looking at me like I'm nuts. I'm saying like hello to everybody on the subway.
So now let's talk about La Part, which is an extraordinary book, very moving in its own way. If A Sweet Life in Paris is about how to become a Parisian, this is about how to become a full-fledged French person.
It's how to live like a local and be
right.
careful what you wish for. Everyone's like, "I want to live like a local." I'm like, no, be a tourist. Come visit, have a great trip, go home, you know,
so,
with your sanity intact.
So tell us about the genesis of the book and just the insane ride that it was.
When I was starting the remodel, I started writing about it on my site, you know, doing little stories and, you know, looking for the sink and, you know, going to the electrical store. And it was funny and it was interesting. And people liked it and they were following along, my readers, and they couldn't wait to see the next chat, you know, da-da-da. And then things started to sort of take a turn for the worse. And
yeah, you had some big-time contractor problems, man.
Right, and I didn't want to put that on the blog because I was going through it, and it was kind of not pleasant.
Super painful.
I mean, we all, you know, everybody who has a blog, we open ourselves up, but, you know, we have things we want personal. Well, the public wasn't really having that. So people were starting to get very, they were like, when are you going to show us more? And when is, you know, and I was just like, the stuff that was happening in my life at that time started, it started getting very serious. And the situation, you know, I was doing all this stuff. I was finding tile and I was looking at flooring, which a lot of it is fun and it's interesting. And I learned like a lot of vocabulary. But on the other hand, you know, when the project started changing, going from this something that was like, wow, I'm designing my dream kitchen to, oh my God,
I'm trying to survive this insane process.
Yeah. You know, they put like the kitchen counter on upside down, like, and they don't want to change, you know, things like that. I'm like, okay. And it was kind of funny. You know, there was these things that were like absurd, but I didn't think people really wanted to hear that stuff. You know, they want to hear about Paris and how fun it is. And
right,
it didn't...
and where to get the best eclair.
Right, exactly. So I kind of stopped writing about it. And then I kind of just kept going with the blog and my life and, you know, the whole story.
At this time, you're making money from the blog.
Well, that wasn't my concern.
I mean,
I was spending a lot more than I was earning.
It
was like 2 to 1.
Right.
And then when it was over, people were like, well, we want to see the big reveal and we want to see your kitchen and we want to see your bedroom and your bathroom. I'm like, my bathroom, you know. And, you know, it's kind of interesting. You become French the longer you live there. And the French people are very private. Like, you don't go to someone's house. Like, oh, we're going to give you the house tour. And we're going to show you, oh, this is our refrigerator. This costs $7,000. And here's the new wall we put up so the kids can't get out. And that was $12,000. And, you know, in France, they don't do that. People are very private.
You're trying to figure out what can go on the blog and what can't.
Right. And also, a lot of these big reveals on people's blogs is because they were sponsored. The, like, you know, the stove manufacturer, the deal was, you know, we're going to give you a stove and then, you know, remodel your kitchen
right.
in exchange for showing it on your blog.
Right.
And I didn't do that. So, and I kind of also, you know, it's my personal space. It's, you know, I'm very, a lot of me, you know, part of me is very private and I'd like to have a private life as well. But people really wanted to know what happened. They're like, well, when are we going to get to see it? And there was enough distance between what happened. I was walking down the street. Actually, I was in New York one day, and I said, you know what? That story was so out there. I need to write a book about it. And no one's going to believe it. They're not going to believe it's nonfiction, but it's a great story. Like, it was so absurd, everything that happened, and crazy and funny now. You know, it's kind of like a recipe for disaster, like the perfect storm. Like, I didn't know what I was doing. It just brewed up to the story. And my publisher's like, yes, your Sweet Life in Paris was a big hit.
You figured that maybe there was a book to be written out of the misadventures.
Yeah, well, one of the things I've done in my life was kind of make a salad and served it out of all the stuff that's happened to me. And, you know, I've lived in Paris. I've written about the city from a real point of view rather than what the French call carte postale Paris or postcard Paris, which I find much more interesting. I find... It's like New York. There's so many like stories here. Like, you don't really want to read about Times Square and how exciting it is. You want to read about the nitty gritty.
Right.
And that's what I find really interesting about Paris. Like the small pastry shops, the things that people don't know that much about. The market, you know, the sort of funny transactions that happen day to day because the French are funny and fun. So I thought, okay, this is a great story. And my publisher loved the idea of it. And they said, you know, The Sweet Life in Paris was a very big success. And I was like, you know, well, I've grown. I've changed a lot during that. I'm matured. I understand France more. When I wrote The Sweet Life in Paris, I was still new. And I was like, oh, my God, there's dog do on the street. You know, there's just like, oh, well, you know, Paris is, you know, the people are, you know, no one has change, which is funny. But now I understand, like, why all those things are that way.
Yeah, but and that was what was interesting to me about the book was you realized— You were constantly buffeted by the headwinds created by your American expectations.
Right. And Americans, we go into situations optimistic. We think everything's going to be great. And then when it doesn't, we have our meltdowns. You know, look at the airport. You know, the flight gets canceled. People have meltdowns at the airport. They're all great until something happens that, you know, the flight attendant runs out of rum and some guy, you know, tries to open the door on the plane, you know. So we go into things optimistically where the French... go into things with more skepticism.
They come from a deficit kind of thinking, like, what could go wrong here?
Right, And they're used to being a little more combative. You know, the French always say we're a Latin culture. So they're used to more, you know, negotiations and things. You know, when you go into a shop in America, you know it's going to be like, hi, how are you? You know, oh, how do you like that shirt? Do you want to get it in green? And in France, you're not sure because the employee is not under like an obligation to sell you like that shirt in medium and green.
And you talk about how returning something in France is impossible.
Well, it's gotten better. You know, it's a challenge. I actually, when Amazon came to France, I bought something from a third-party dealer. And the whole thing with Amazon is you can return anything. I was like, I'm going to buy a hard drive. And I bought the wrong one. I bought the one for Windows, not Mac. So I wanted to exchange it. And the guy's like, no. And I know, like, you know, Amazon has a policy. They make all their – and so I wrote to Amazon. And like 10 minutes later, the guy wrote me back. He goes, please send it back to me. So it's getting better. It's changing. You know, one of the things when you write a book about Paris, too, Paris changes fast.
Right.
You know, the things that were true then have changed, you know. So, you know, it is getting, the customer service is getting better. A lot of younger people are taking over, you know, in restaurants and so forth. You know, they still have, you know, certain traditions that.
But you also talk about just the sheer red tape.
Yeah.
The expectations of every encounter are completely different.
Right. And you, once again, you don't know. Sometimes you have to be forceful to get what you want. You have to. Because it's, you know, it's a game in a lot of
ways. And that's not your nature.
Right, not at all. Luckily, my partner is like the most incredible person. I've watched him get things and how he does it. And he will not let, he's like a pit bull. And he's tiny, he's a little tiny guy. But he will not let go. And he'll circle back at people and they go, oh, c'est pas possible. He's like, why are you telling me that? Why, you know, that's not true. I know you can do this. And yeah, the people
it
are
seems
like, way okay, yes.
It seems like Roman, or whatever his real name is,
Roman,
is the hero of the book.
Well, that's, yeah, I didn't realize that until people told me. People who read the book, they're like, he's such a treasure. I'm like, yeah. But then I realized he really is, and he doesn't know that because he doesn't know how special he is. And, you know, I try to tell him because I believe in doing, you know, that kind of stuff. He's French, and he really stood up. He really took care of me, and other French friends did too. You know, once again, the book is not an anti-French. It's just the story happened to happen in France.
Right.
And French friends really helped me, and French architects and the notaires and were great, fantastic people. I couldn't have asked for better people around me. But my partner really was amazing, and watching him yell at people, I was like, can you hold on? Let me get my phone because this is going to go viral on YouTube. You're going to be like a sensation. This little tiny French guy yelling at all these people and and not taking no, you know, just going up to their face. You know, he's like half their size. It was amazing. Unbelievable.
One of the things I couldn't believe is how much paper occurs in every transaction.
Yeah. When you order something like a toilet seat cover, you get like a bon de commande, which is a piece of paper. And then you get another piece of paper, like with the receipt for the down payment. So it's a full-size sheet of paper, not like a little slip. Then when you get it, they stamp those. And then they give you like a facture, which is like the bill. And then there's a quittance. And so, you know, you come out with like this stack of papers. It's like, this is not very ecological. But that's the system that they have. And they don't really know how to...
Yeah, to switch to Square.
Yeah. It's, you know, well, how do you do things that, you know, they want paperwork. They want proof of everything. So you keep all that stuff, and you have to keep it for your whole life. And you have to keep, like, every electrical bill you have. And if you don't have one, you know, they're going to ask for it someday. Like, where were you in, like, April of 2014? I'm like, I don't know where the bill is. Yeah.
So give me your three craziest moments that you can remember in renovating your dream kitchen and apartment. Like, what are the three things that stand out?
Well, I can't really tell you because there are a lot of spoilers in the book.
Yeah, okay. So I don't want to give away any spoilers. Yeah,
I can't really say.
Okay.
How's that?
That's fair.
Well, because, you know, when I go out and do talk about the book, I go, and then they, you know, this was...
Right.
And everyone's like, oh, because I build up to these stories.
Right. Okay. All right.
So...
Well, we have to say that you experience tremendous dissonance in creating this dream kitchen, and you ran into all kinds of problems with things. It's an age-old problem. It's Mr. Blandings builds his dream house,
right,
with Cary Grant.
Well, I would say one of the things that was the biggest surprise for me was finding a box of condoms in my apartment and the construction site. That was probably something I can talk about.
But they were new condoms.
Well, they were, but they were open. The box was opened, and I didn't count them. But
that's good. So, you know, I was very moved by the epilogue because you talk about what you learned, and I thought it was very valuable. Lesson for people living anywhere?
Well, I learned if you want to be comfortable, stay home. You know, if you want life to be, you know, you want to watch TV, watch your favorite shows, not have to worry about returning things, stay home, and that's fine. There's nothing wrong with that. You know, you take a chance, and that's when, you know, you took a chance creating Serious Eats. It might not have worked out, and it, you know, it happened to have worked out, but you took a chance. If you didn't take a chance, it wouldn't have happened. Mm-hmm. So taking a chance is usually an okay thing, and it's also okay to fail at things.
Right.
I have failed at things in my life.
Me too.
And you learn from them, and you don't have success unless you fail. You have to screw up.
Yeah. I always think that, you know, to do what you did or even to do what I know for me, what I did at Serious Eats is, in a way, to create something from a blank piece of paper requires not just faith, but a precipitating factor, and it's usually involving loss. Like in my case, I lost my parents when I was a teenager, and you know, you lost your partner, and even though that's incredibly painful, somehow I think those kinds of losses spur people to do things.
Well, yeah, pain is a good motivator. Loss is very difficult. People don't know how hard it is. And I remember after I lost my partner, walking around the streets for years after, I would just look at people and going, wow, so many people are going through this and you would never know it. Because a lot of times, you know, somebody loses, like, they say losing a child is like the worst thing in the world. And it happened. You see it on TV and you change the channel. You know, you're just like, oh, I wonder what Jennifer Aniston's next movie's about. I'm, you know, and really, you think, you know, you just imagine how devastated it is for people. But a lot of people who have had terminal illnesses, they become very motivated to succeed, to tell their story. There's a fellow, ABC News, he had like a full blow. He was a cocaine addict. He had an anxiety, Dan Harris.
Yeah, and then now, he started 10% happier.
Yeah, now he's like this meditation guru. Yeah. And he's kind of a cool guy. He's not like, you have to sit in a lotus position.
Right.
You know, so he was motivated by that to share that part of his life. And, you know, you look at, well, I don't know if you want to go there, but you look at, well, never mind.
No, it's okay. Why?
Oh, I was going to say, you look at drag queens who have had very hard lives because... you know, a friend of mine who was one in San Francisco said, you know, you never mess with a drag queen because we've been messed with all our lives and we don't take it anymore. But they have, a lot of them have hard lives.
Yeah.
Had difficult childhoods. You know, it's difficult to walk around in, you know, clothing.
Cool. Yeah. Right. Yeah. Wow.
And they do it. Yeah. And they're amazing. And they're amazing individuals. They're brave, courageous people.
Right.
I couldn't do it. I probably, you know, wouldn't be very good at it, which is why I shouldn't do it.
your takeaways from the experience of the of renovating the apartment is, if you want to be comfortable, stay home.
Right. And make sure your home, make sure if you buy a home that it's, or does it need to be remodeled?
All right. Finally, let's talk about briefly about the 10th anniversary edition of The Perfect Scoop. Every ice cream nerd I know, including, as I said, Max Falkowitz, swears by it. Why did you do the 10th anniversary edition? Like, what's different and what did you add? And
you know, it became a bestseller. You know, it was interesting when I proposed the book years ago, a publisher turned it down because they said that I didn't have a show on TV. So my 10 Speed Press bought it. And they said it was the fastest book they've ever acquired. They had an acquisition meeting where they all sit in a room, a conference room, and they look at the titles.
Oh, I know all about those meetings.
And they said it was decided like within 2 seconds. They said, yes, we're buying the book.
Right.
And I had wanted, you know, I didn't realize how many people were making ice cream, but there wasn't really a book at the time that was kind of a basic guidebook. There was a couple books that were pretty good, but they weren't like a basics book. And I wanted to do sort of almost a textbook, but just, you know, nothing technical. Just how to make ice cream at home. Here's really good, solid recipes. here's a bunch of mix-ins, all those things that we love, like swirls and crunch and candies and nuts and toasted, you know, whatever, toasted marshmallow filling and all these things that go into ice cream. And it was so fun to do. And I read somewhere there was it's the number one ice cream book in the world in terms of sales. Someone can email you at ed@series. But if that's not true. But when the publisher said, well, would you like to redo it? Would you like to do an updated edition? I said, yeah, it'd be great. Because we don't get a chance to go back in life and redo things.
Sure.
And over the years, I use my books all the time. And now I'm like, oh, I would do it this way. I would do that this way. And no one's going to make that ice cream. What if I switched it with this? So I actually ended up rewriting the whole book.
Wow.
Usually when you do an update, it's just a new introduction.
I revised and expanded New York Eats back in 1991. I revised it in 90. I didn't do the whole book all over again.
Yeah, I did. Because
You're crazy.
Yeah, I'm crazy.
Okay.
But it was fun, and I love making ice cream. I added, 10 or 12 new recipes. I took a few out, and they're funny because they were like weird recipes. Not weird, but just things that were curiosities.
Right.
And people are writing to me like, why'd you get rid of that recipe? And I'm like, well, if you have the old book, just hold on to it.
It's so cool. Everyone needs to get the perfect scoop. All right. So now it's time for the special sauce, All You Can Answer Buffet Day. There's a lot of pressure.
I should have studied. I didn't know this was coming.
There's more pressure than, picking out a tile for a kitchen in Paris.
In French. When there's a different word for red tile versus green tile.
Exactly.
It's not.
So who's at your last supper, no family allowed?
I think I would like Marianne Cunningham, Alice Medrich, Flo Breaker, and Carol Field, because they were someone said they were the classy ladies of baking.
So we should explain, though, all four are seminal figures in baking.
Right.
Flo Breaker books.
The Simple Art of Perfect Baking,
right.
Sweet Miniatures. But I used to say when she was alive, she passed away last year, I said, when they start cloning people, they should use her. Because she was the world's most lovely person. And
right.
She was an amazing baker. And she was and I don't mean to insult anybody with this. Once again, send Ed your emails. But she was a wealthy housewife. She didn't need to work. She lived in a very huge house. But she wore diamond rings. But she was just a lovely baker. And so I'd love to have her back and Marianne Cunningham back and Carol.
Marianne Cunningham, the famous Fannie Farmer, right? Was the original Fannie Farmer cookbook author. So
she was tough.
Right. But wouldn't you be bored by all just pastry chefs or chefs? Like, wouldn't you want, I don't know, Michelle Obama, Macron, Robespierre? I don't know.
But I wouldn't have anything in common with them.
Oh, all right.
I mean, Macron, I could say, I could talk to him about France.
Right.
But I don't, I'm not fancy. And I was actually telling somebody, I said, well, I'm really bad at dinner parties because I'm awkward. I'm used to being around food people. I'm used to walking to restaurant people. And who I'm comfortable with.
So what would you be eating at the Last Supper? Give me the menu.
Oh, gosh. Well,
the Japanese menu cookbook, I want the menu.
Well, if this is what I want to eat.
Yeah.
It would be fried chicken. Fried chicken is my favorite food in the world.
Top three for me, for sure.
Top one. I love fried chicken. It's something I don't eat very often because it's, not the best thing for you.
Sides?
Sides are okay, but, coleslaw. I don't need all the sides, crispy skin. I'd rather you.
How about biscuits with the fried chicken?
I don't care about the biscuits.
You don't care
biscuits. I like all
that
stuff.
Big news.
But, it's the fried chicken.
Okay.
It's like drinking champagne. You don't need anything else with
it.
You don't need to put cassis in it. You don't need a twist of lemon. You just need a glass of really good champagne.
And what are you listening to?
I am listening to right now Stevie Wonder.
What period of Stevie Wonder?
Like Songs in the Key of Life.
Songs in the Key of Life is one of the great Stevie Wonders.
It's like, how did he do this? Like, it was brilliant.
It was brilliant. Yeah. It was amazing. I love Songs in the Key of Life. I love that.
There's one song I hate, but I always skip through that.
Which one?
It's like Sir Duke.
I like Sir Duke.
You can have it.
Because I'm a huge jazz fan.
Oh, see, I hate jazz. I dislike jazz.
Oh, man. We got to stop this episode of Special Sauce right now.
All right. Well, it's nice to talk to you.
Dave, really. Do you have, this is particularly interesting for pastry chef, do you have guilty pleasures?
No, I actually don't have any food that I feel guilty about eating, aside from fried chicken. I love pepperoni pizza. I love bourbon. I love whiskey. I love cocktails.
You don't feel guilty about eating or drinking any of those things?
No. And, you know, when I left the restaurant business, I had to moderate what I ate because I was eating all, I had access to everything, foie gras, you know, anything.
You're a skinny
butter.
Dude, man.
Well, I lost some weight the last few years because, you know, I was just eating food all the time.
Yeah, yeah.
And I changed the way I eat, too. I'm careful about what I eat.
Right.
And I'm actually one of the few people that lose weight when they come to America.
Right.
Because in France, I eat like bread, cheese, and wine.
I love the way in La Part you talk about the right way to eat the edge of the baguette.
The baguette, yeah.
So tell people about that. That is so awesome.
Well, it's just, it's a sort of inadvertent thing you do when you leave a bakery and you pull the end off. It's called the quignon. With a Q, started Q-U-I-G-N-O-N. And it's something Parisians do. And baguettes are Parisian. They're not necessarily French.
Mm-hmm.
They were a bread that was designed for factory workers mm-hmm. to have a loaf of bread they could bring to work and carry it. The word baguette also means chopsticks, like chopsticks are bread. So it's magic wand. But the baguette is Parisian. You can get them outside of Paris, but it's a Parisian thing. You pull off the end and you eat it on the street. You sort of do that when you're coming out of the bakery and, you know, people make a big deal about it, like online, like, aren't you going to pull the end off? It's like, well, it's something you do. You don't think about it.
Right.
You don't make a big show of it.
That's so awesome. But
sometimes I just not, like my hands are dirty. So I'll just like take the baguette and I'll put it in my mouth because I'm a little, not a clean freak, but I like to, you know, wash my hands.
You know,
I'm a baker. So like I'll stick the whole thing in my mouth. I'll like rip the tip off.
So three books that have influenced your life the most.
Well, I would probably say the Chez Panisse cookbook.
Okay.
I would say The Sheltering Sky by Paul Bowles,
mm-hmm.
Which was just an amazing story.
It's a fascinating book.
And there was a book I read a really long time ago. It's called Summerhill, about a school in England.
Oh, it's funny. My mother, may she rest in peace. Love that book. That's an old, not a recent book.
No, it was called, the subtitle was called A Radical Approach to Child Rearing. And I think I read it in high school.
I think that's where I went wrong.
Well, see,
I was her radical approach to child rearing.
Well, you were the failure. But the whole idea, for people that don't know, his whole thing was let kids do whatever they want and they'll decide what's best for them.
Right.
And I don't know why. I just thought that it was such a great, like, especially because kids are so controlled. It's like, do this and raise them this way. It's like, no, just let them do what they do. And they'll come out okay.
Yeah, for sure.
So I don't know why that came up, but...
Three things in your kitchen that you can't do without.
My scale.
Okay.
I love having a scale, especially because I write in both metrics
and
pounds. And
you agree with Stella Parks, Brave Tart, about scales, and Kenji for that matter. And Dale
I have no choice.
Yeah. Okay.
I'm a baker.
Right.
I love my stand mixer.
Okay.
I'm a big fan of my stand mixer.
And you only have one stand mixer?
Well, I have two.
Got it.
They gave me like the giant one. I did some work with the company that makes the mixer, and they gave me like the huge one, and I never use that. I'm like, I make a cake for one.
Right.
You know what I love? And I was at the Le Creuset factory, and I was like, please, whatever you do, do not stop making that spatula. It's called a spoon spatula, and it's got... It's a spatula, but it's got like a sort of rounded. So when
it's
you're
a curved,
yeah, it's
edge.
Got like a little bowl to it. And it's the perfect spatula. It fits right in the bowl. It's great for folding stuff. I said, whatever you do, I don't care if you shut the factory down. Do not stop making those spatulas.
Right.
And they gave me like a handful of them, and I was
so great.
Oh my God,
it's like Christmas.
Yeah, I was so, and I actually give them to people.
Right.
So
that's cool.
I love those. So.
It's just been declared David Leibovitz Day all over the world.
Negronis for everyone. No.
What's happening on that day? So Negronis for everyone.
No. Homemade Rocky Road for everybody with homemade marshmallows.
Okay.
Dark chocolate, cocoa nibs, and a little bit of salt.
Okay.
And peanuts, candied peanuts.
Candied peanuts.
Or candied almonds.
Right. So that's it. Like, that's a great menu.
Yeah. Well, the Negronis I can back up on and say cocktail of your choice.
Okay.
It's on the house.
Or you do a Negroni like slushy in one of your books,
right? The ice cream, but the new ice cream book, The Perfect Scoop, I introduced a bunch of frozen cocktails.
Yeah.
Because I kind of learned that bakers are like bartenders. We're combining different ingredients to come up with something new. And I love cocktails and I love frozen desserts, so why not combine?
So they're not doing anything but eating and drinking on David Leibovitz Day.
Well, what else would you do? I mean, what else? Yeah, there's. We're only here on Earth to do three things, like breathe, reproduce, and eat. And I don't want to get involved with people's reproduce. You know, I'll let people reproduce on their own without me.
Got it.
People can breathe on their own too, but eating, I'll take some control over that.
Perfect. Thank you so much for sharing your special sauce with us, David Leibovitz. It's been awesome to have you. Really, it's been so much fun. Log on to davidleibovitz.com for David's latest musings, and do check out his terrific new book, La Part. You might never fantasize about buying an apartment in Paris again, or maybe it won't dissuade you at all. Who knows? And because it's summer, the perfect scoop must be on your book shopping list. So long, Serious Eaters, and we'll see you next time. And David, it's been a pleasure.
Thank you, Ed. It was great to be here, and I loved coming here and seeing you in person
rather
than just listening to your podcast.
Yeah, it's awesome.